Snowball by Paul Anderson. Section 1. It did not come out of some government laboratory, employing 1,000 bright young technicians whose lives had been checked back to the crib. It was the work of one man and one woman. This is not the reversal of history you might think, for the truth is that all the really basic advances have been made by one or a few men. From the first to steal fire out of a volcano to E equals MC squared. Later, the bright young technicians get hold of it, and we have transoceanic airplanes and nuclear bombs. But the idea is always born in loneliness. Simon Arch was 32 years old. He came from upstate Massachusetts, the son of a small-town doctor, and his childhood and adolescence were normal enough, aside from tinkering with mathematics and explosive mixtures. In spite of shyness and an overly large vocabulary, he was popular, especially since he was a good basketball player. After high school, he spent a couple of tedious years in the tail end of World War II clerking for the Army, somehow never getting overseas. Weak eyes may have had something to do with that. In his spare time, he read a great deal, and after the war, he entered MIT with a major in physics. Everybody and his dog was studying physics then, but Arch was better than average, and went on through a series of graduate assistantships to a PhD. He married one of his students and patented an electronic valve. Its value was limited to certain special applications, but the royalties provided a small independent income, and he realized his ambition to work for himself. He and Elizabeth built a house in Westfield, which lies some 50 miles north of Boston, and has a small college. Otherwise, it is only a shopping center for the local farmers. The house had a walled garden and a separate laboratory building. Equipment for the lab was expensive enough to make the Arches postpone children. Indeed, after its requirements were met, they had little enough to live on, but they made sarcastic remarks about the installment-buying rat race and kept out of it. Besides, they had hopes for the latest project. There might be real money in that. Colin Calhoun, professor of physics at Westfield, was Arch's closest friend, a huge, red-haired, boisterous man with radical opinions on politics, which were always good for an argument. Arch, tall and slim and dark, with horn-rimmed glasses over black eyes and a boyishly smooth face, labeled himself a reactionary. "Dielectrics, eh?" rumbled Calhoun one sunny May afternoon. "So that's your latest kick, laddie. What about it?" "I have some ideas on the theory of dielectric polarization," said Arch. "It's still not too well understood, you know." "Yeah?" Calhoun turned as Elizabeth brought in a tray of dude glasses. "Thank you kindly." One hairy hand engulfed the goblet, and he drank noisily. "Ah, your taste in beer is as good as your taste in politics is moldy. Go on." Arch looked at the floor. "Maybe I shouldn't," he said, feeling his old nervousness rise within him. "You see, I'm operating purely on a hunch. I've got the math pretty well whipped into shape, but it all rests on an unproven postulate about the nature of the electric field. I've tried to fit it in with both relativity and quantum mechanics, and, well, like I said, it's all just a notion of mine, which demands experimental proof before I can even think about publishing." "What sort of proof?" "It's this way. By far the best dielectric found to date is a mixture of barium and strontium titanates. Under optimum conditions, the dielectric constant goes up to 11,600, though the loss rate is still pretty high. There's a partial explanation for this on the basis of crystal theory. The dipole moment increases under an electric field. Well, you know that. My notion involves an assumption about the nature of crystalline ionic bond. I threw in a correction for relativistic and quantum effects, which looks kosher, but really hasn't much evidence to back it up. So..."